So we're looking at that first passage that we read, Exodus 24, verse 12, to chapter 25, verse 9. And if you look then at chapter 24, in between verse 11, that meal on Sinai, where God himself is present and the covenant is cemented, to use that language that we employed last week, in between that and verse 12, Moses and his 73 companions descend the mountain. We're clearly meant to assume that that happens so that in verse 12, Moses can then be called back up the mountain again. Come up to me, Yahweh says there at the beginning of verse 12. And with this next ascent by Moses, he must be a very fit old man, mustn't he? With this next ascent, three things are different. Number one, this time he's almost alone. There are no elders, there are no Aaron and his sons. I say almost alone. He does take Joshua. Joshua, you remember, has been mentioned once before. He led the Israelite army as they fought the Amalekites back in chapter 17. Now, apparently, he has this role as Moses' assistant. And Moses does take him, but only, it seems, for some of the way at the top of the mountain in verses 15 to 18. There's no mention of Joshua. So the fact then that this is more or less a solo expedition, that's one difference from before. Then number two, this time he's on the mountain for longer. You begin to suspect, don't you, a protracted expedition when he gives that instruction in verse 14. Wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute, let him go to them. And then, of course, it's confirmed in verse 18. Moses was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. So that's another distinctive thing about this ascent, its lengthy duration. And then number three, this time Moses isn't going up the mountain to receive law. Of course, he will be given the tablets of stone. That's mentioned right at the outset in verse 12. But that's just the Ten Commandments that he had received back in chapter 20, now put down in writing. It isn't new material. Really, what he's going up the mountain for here is to receive a plan, a blueprint for a building project, namely the construction of the sanctuary, as it's called in chapter 25, verse 8, or the tabernacle, as it's called there in the following verse, verse 9. And this third difference, then, is the crucial one, the architectural flavour, if you like, of this session on Sinai. And so it is that almost without any introduction, Yahweh launches into this list of materials in chapter 25, verses 3 to 7. Indeed, I love the way that the reason for the list comes after the list itself. Years ago, Hannah and I were on our way into a meeting in Glasgow. And as we walked through the foyer of this church building, a man whom I'd never seen before in my life smiled very warmly at me and said, "Ah, how are you doing? Have you been doing much painting lately?" I don't know who he thought I was, presumably some artistic or perhaps odd job man acquaintance of his. But for me, it was one of those moments of complete disorientation when your mind's spinning. Am I missing something here? Am I being really dense in not understanding what this guy means? And I think I just kind of lamely responded, no painting recently, and carried on through the foyer. And Moses must have felt similarly disorientated here, bombarded with this list. You can imagine his eyes growing wider and wider. Gold, silver, bronze, blue and purple and scarlet yarns. What's going on? What's this about? Has Yahweh confused me with someone else? Is there some background to this that I should know and I'm missing? And it's only subsequently then in verses 8 and 9 that it all starts to make some sense. It perhaps indicates Yahweh's sheer enthusiasm for this project. I mean, we do things like this, don't we? Arriving home from a football match that we've been at. We're so excited about the winning goal that we omit who was playing who and what the final score was, and we leave everyone bewildered as we rush breathlessly into a detailed blow-by-blow account of this particular goal. And Yahweh here is passionate about this tabernacle. And if we may say it reverently, then he can't wait. He can't wait for it to be built. And so as soon as Moses arrives at the mountaintop, he rushes breathlessly into a list of its materials. It's interesting that he wants these materials to be contributed by the Israelites. That's very clear, isn't it, in verses 1 to 3. Two things about that. At first, the Israelites must be in a position to contribute them. Yet they are a presently landless bunch of former slaves. So how are they in a position to contribute the materials listed here? Well, presumably because you remember the Egyptians heaped stuff on the Israelites at the time of the Exodus. Probably not acacia wood mentioned there in verse 5. I doubt the Israelites hauled great timber logs with them as they left Egypt and crossed the desert. They would be able to source that from the forest near their encampment at Sinai anyway. But we know from earlier in the book that the Egyptian donations included gold, silver, and clothing. So that's the first two items on this list covered, as well as possibly some of the fabrics mentioned there in verse 4. And it's not difficult to imagine, is it, that spices, for instance, mentioned in verse 6, might also have been gifted by the Egyptians at that time. And so those parting gifts from the Egyptians are probably the main answer to the question, how are the Israelites in a position to contribute these materials? And it's kind of the icing on the cake, this, in terms of Yahweh's assertion of his dominance. Here's Egypt, this supposed superpower, supposedly blessed and protected by all these epic deities that it worships. And Yahweh wants his people out of there. And it isn't a headache for him. And it doesn't involve him in a titanic struggle. He effortlessly wreaks havoc on the place, lashing it with plagues, destroying its livestock, destroying its crops, destroying even its families in the end, and so removing his people. But that's not quite enough for him. He wants one more thing from the Egyptians before he's done with them. In addition to his people, he has a tabernacle to build, and he wants them to foot the bill for it. And so they must hand over their valuables as the Israelites leave in order to bankroll Yahweh's construction project. Don't you just love the imperiousness of the God of the Bible? Utterly unfazed by the Egypts of this world doing with them exactly as he pleases. So the Israelites are in a position to contribute. But then the other thing about the contribution set out in verses 1 to 3 is its voluntariness. Verse 2, from every man whose heart moves him, you shall receive the contribution for me. So this isn't a mandatory payment. No taxman is going to go around knocking on all the tent doors, demanding that every Israelite coughs up. Remember Paul's great statement in 2 Corinthians 9, verse 7, God loves a cheerful giver. And if anything confirms beyond doubt the truth of that, surely it's this. Because here, these Israelite contributions are needed. They're needed for the tabernacle to be built. And we've said Yahweh really, really wants the tabernacle to be built. Perhaps you've been involved with some charity or other organization that was raising funds for a particular project. And as the fundraising went on, you were so obsessed with reaching that target that you almost didn't care where the money came from. And someone could have robbed a bank and you would have welcomed the gift with open arms. And if there's one occasion then when Yahweh might drop his principles about giving with the right motives and doing it with a cheerful heart and all that stuff, surely it's now. Surely in his eagerness to get this tabernacle erected, he won't care if the Israelites have to be dragged kicking and screaming with their contributions. But he does care. Even when the building of the tabernacle is at stake, he's not interested in grudging gifts. He would rather such gifts remained in their owner's safes, even if it means the delay or the cancellation of his project. He really does love a cheerful giver. Which should cause each of us to ask this morning, is my giving to the Lord's work cheerful? Is it driven by a keen sense of the riches of God's grace lavished on me in Christ? Is it the overflow of a heart full of gratitude for salvation? So these items in verses 3 to 7, then, they are to be contributed. And I've shared with you a couple of thoughts about that. But let me now cut to the chase and tell you what I find most striking of all when it comes to this list. It's the earthiness, the earthiness, I'm going to call it, of the whole thing. Remember, we're talking here about a sanctuary. That's what our text calls it. That's what it calls this building, a sanctuary. We're talking about a very special and sacred edifice. And yet, surprisingly, there's no attempt to surround the tabernacle structure with a sense of mystique. There's no pretense that it's made of fairy dust, that it has some kind of ethereal composition. No, verses 3 to 7 insist it's made of physical, tangible, earthy, this-worldly stuff. What I want to do then in the rest of our time this morning is ask a question. This earthiness of the tabernacle, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Is it admirable or is it regrettable? And I want to be awkward and answer the question in these two ways. This earthiness, from one perspective, it's the tabernacle's weakness, and from another perspective, it's the tabernacle's strength. Let's consider each of those in turn. First of all, then, from one perspective, it's the tabernacle's weakness. This earthiness, from one perspective, it's the tabernacle's weakness. Look with me for a moment at chapter 25, verse 9 there. Exactly as I show you concerning the pattern of the tabernacle and of all its furniture, so you shall make it. Exactly as I show you. So there's a real concern here for exactness. Now, to us, that might seem perfectly reasonable. Of course, an architectural design has to be followed exactly. Otherwise, the construction will infringe building regulations and break the terms of the planning permission and possibly run over budget, etc., etc. But we need to remember that Exodus 25 isn't set in 21st century Britain. The men erecting this tabernacle will have no building inspectors breathing down their necks, no members of the local planning authority, no accountants thrusting spreadsheets in their faces. So why then the concern for exactness here? If the builders do deviate a bit here and there, well, is that really such a big deal? Well, the text itself doesn't explain the concern for exactness. However, we get the explanation somewhere else. But first, an illustration. Think of Shakespeare's Globe being built there on the banks of the Thames in the 1990s. And suppose in that construction project, the builders had at certain points gone, as it were, off-piste. Forget this open-air feature in the plans. We'll put a good, sturdy roof on this building to keep the audiences nice and dry. And as for the plainness of the whole thing in this design that we've been given, we'll rectify that. We'll include a large foyer area complete with a coffee bar and amusement arcade. Now, such deviations by the builders would have provoked an outcry, wouldn't they? Not because of concerns about building regulations and planning permission and budget considerations, but for a deeper reason, namely that structure is a replica of something else, of the 17th century theatre in which Shakespeare's plays were first staged. And necessarily then, a replica must be exact. It must accurately conform to the thing that it's replicating. Now, you remember that reading in Hebrews 8 earlier in our service this morning? It talked about the tabernacle. And what did it call the tabernacle? It called it a replica, a copy. That was the actual word it used. According to Hebrews 8 verse 5, the tabernacle was a copy. And that verse indeed expressly gives that as the reason for the exactness. Shakespeare's Globe had to be built with exactness because it's a copy, and the tabernacle, Hebrews 8 verse 5 says, had to be built with exactness because it's a copy. However, the writer to the Hebrews highlights something about the way in which the tabernacle is a copy, and it's here that the Shakespeare's Globe analogy breaks down. You see, that theatre there in London, it's a copy, but the copy functions just as well as the original. Hannah and I once watched a performance of Hamlet there, and I'm sure Mark Rylance, as the title character, was as brilliant and engaging that night as any Hamlet in the 1600s would have been. The copy functions just as well as the original. It's not like that with the tabernacle. One day, a few months ago, we had a large box of Lego out in our living room, and I seemed to get far more fun out of this than anybody else did, and I built a ferry. It was intended to resemble one of the Calmac ferries that you get in Scotland, and I was very pleased with my efforts. But even so, for all my self-congratulation, I would be the first to admit that you couldn't put a load of real-life holidaymakers on that ferry and ship them across to some Hebridean island. That is to say, the copy could never, in a million years, function just as well as the original. For 1,001 reasons it couldn't. It was way too small, it wasn't seaworthy, it had no engine or navigation equipment, etc., etc., etc. And that's the kind of copy that we're talking about when it comes to the tabernacle, an utterly unworkable copy. All the stuff that would go on in that tabernacle building, all the work of priests dealing with the sins of God's people, it wasn't real. It was play acting. It was the equivalent of pushing my ferry across the living room floor, making an engine noise with my mouth, and pretending it's a voyage to Stornoway. Why? Why is the tabernacle a Lego ferry kind of copy rather than a Shakespeare's Globe kind of copy? Why is it so unworkable? Well, precisely because of this earthiness that we're talking about this morning. You see, the sins of human beings can only be dealt with in heaven. Only there can sins be atoned for. Only there can sinners be interceded for. In heaven, it has to happen there. And obviously, self-evidently, you can't conjure up heaven on the Sinai Peninsula using a bit of acacia wood and some goat skin. No, you can conjure up a 17th century theatre a few hundred years later on the banks of the Thames. You just use the same materials that were there in the original, and you've got pretty much an identical replica. Here, it's the very fact that the Israelites are having to use materials at all that makes the replica so inauthentic. The original, in this case, has no materials. Heaven isn't composed of wood and metal and linen. The tabernacle's earthiness is its weakness. It makes it an unworkable little toy model. Or in the language of that verse there in Hebrews 8, a shadow, because that's the full expression there, isn't it? A copy and a shadow. You know what a shadow's like. It isn't the real thing, is it? You walk up to your car on a sunny day and its shadow is there alongside it. And it's detailed, that shadow. You can see the wing mirror of your car. You can see the roof bars of your car. Everything's there. But you try and get into it and drive off and you'll look pretty silly, won't you? It isn't real. And this earthy tabernacle then, it isn't real. And this is why the writer to the Hebrews, you see, gets so excited about Jesus. Listen again to what he says there in chapter 8, verses 1 and 2. Remember his words? The point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. Or chapter 9, verses 11 and 12. We didn't read these verses, but it's the same thing again. There, he writes, when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places. And then again, verse 24 of chapter 9, Christ has entered not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. You see the point? Jesus is the first and only priest to do his priestly stuff in the true tabernacle rather than in a toy model. And that last verse we read just there, It's saying he's doing it right now. Now to appear on our behalf. He's doing it there right now. As we sing sometimes, his powerful blood did once atone, and now it pleads before the throne. Isn't that wonderful? Some of you are very conscious this morning, perhaps, of sins in your past. Sins that seem to shout out to God against you. Let me tell you, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, God doesn't hear them. They are a pathetic whisper, utterly drowned out by the pleading blood of our great high priest, who's right there in God's very presence, right before God, in heaven itself, on our behalf. So what do we do then with this list of materials in Exodus 25, verses 3 to 7? Well, in the first place, we look down our noses at it. We shake our heads pityingly at the sheer earthiness of this tabernacle. And we thank God with all our hearts that we this morning have a priest who's at work in heaven. That we can sing before the throne of God above, I have a strong, a perfect plea. And I know that while in heaven he stands, no tongue can bid me thence depart. Our priest doesn't mess about this morning in some rickety physical structure somewhere. No, he presents his sin-dismantling sacrifice where it matters, where it counts, where God's throne actually is. He's exalted above the heavens, Hebrews 7, 26. Be assured of that, believer. Don't fear your guilt. Don't fear your moral ineligibility. Don't fear your checkered past. You have a priest in heaven. You have a priest in heaven. That overrides everything. You have a priest in heaven. So this earthiness then, I'm saying that from one perspective, it's the tabernacle's weakness. And it points us, by contrast, to the true tent and the true priest who this morning is ministering there on our behalf. But then, secondly, from another perspective, it's the tabernacle's strength, this earthiness. From another perspective, it's the tabernacle's strength. Look at chapter 25, verse 8. And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst. I mean, the juxtaposition of verses 3 to 7, this list of materials, and then verse 8, that grand statement there, the juxtaposition just seems crazy, doesn't it? You go on a tour, an official tour of St. James's Park, and one of the things that they show you is the changing rooms, and the home changing room is very impressive. The away changing room is completely different. It's like the sort of thing that you remember from your school days. It has a very low ceiling. Apparently the showers don't work very well. Apparently the condensation is dreadful. And it's quite a thought then, the incongruity of these pampered, rich footballers from Manchester United and Liverpool and all these teams having to kind of cramp themselves into this little changing room whenever they're playing Newcastle. And it seems so incongruous here in our passage, doesn't it? God, this God of glory, according to chapter 24, the one whose glory is there above the mountain at Sinai, this God of glory coming into such close proximity with all this physicality and all its kind of nitty-gritty earthiness. But then you let your mind go back to the beginning of the Bible story, indeed the beginning of history. And you think of Eden. And Eden was very earthy. It was a garden. A garden with trees and rivers, Genesis tells us. In fact, intriguingly, in Genesis 2, in the description of Eden there, gold is mentioned, just as it's mentioned here in this list. Onyx stones are mentioned, just as they're mentioned in this list. And yet God walked there, didn't he, with Adam, seemingly on a regular basis. And Adam then didn't have to be teleported from the garden to some different kind of realm whenever God wanted to walk with him. No, God was in the garden. And there, in that earthy setting, that very physical, tree-filled, river-filled, stone-filled, metal-filled setting, there God walked with Adam. But then after the fall in Genesis 3, it seems as though there's something of a divine withdrawal, isn't there? A divine withdrawal from the created order. God kind of retreats from it. But I would put it to you then that what we have here, this list of items belonging to the created order, followed by that startling remark in verse 8, that I may dwell in their midst. What we have here is the beginning of a reuniting of God and the physical order. And it's only the beginning. And this theme then of God attaching himself to the earthy, it will become more and more pronounced. So that eventually we'll come to John chapter 1, verse 14. And that mind-blowing statement, the Word, who we've discovered in verse 1, is God. The Word was God. The Word dwelt among us. And as some of you will know, the Greek verb that John uses is literally tabernacled. The Word tabernacled among us. But not now in acacia wood and goatskins. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. At least acacia wood was a robust kind of substance. Flesh that could be whipped. Flesh that could have nails battered through it. Flesh that could be torn and attached to a cross. This attachment of God to the earthy is extraordinary. And then 1 Corinthians 6, verse 19, a bit later in the New Testament, we have another mind-blowing statement. This time focusing on God the Spirit, this time using temple rather than tabernacle language. Your body, Paul writes to the Corinthians, your body, your physical body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. Wow, what an attachment of God and the physical. And then finally, this trajectory reaches its culmination at the very end of the Bible, in Revelation chapter 1, verses 1 to 3, where John writes, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth." So this very physical setting. And he continues, "I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God." And then verse 3, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them and they will be his people." God dwelling with man in a heaven and an earth. A physical, created setting. And so I'm saying then, we look at this list here in Exodus 25, 3-7. And yes, in the first place, we should look down our noses at it and shake our heads pityingly. But then, having reacted in that way and worked through the train of thought that we worked through in the first part of our sermon, having done that, we should then move to a second train of thought and slowly start to appreciate the beauty, actually. The beauty of this juxtaposition, all this physicality, and then I will dwell. And it should make us anticipate with excitement the day when God really will walk with us, surrounded by acacia trees and stones and dugongs. I hope that's the correct rendering, as you can see in the footnote of the goat skins, because when you look at dugongs, they're very fascinating creatures. And we shall dwell then, God shall dwell with us among all that physicality and createdness in a new world. That's the culmination of the trajectory that is faintly seen here in Exodus 25. 25. And let me just close coming at this same idea from a slightly different angle. I read one more passage from Hebrews earlier, didn't I? Now, Hebrews is full of the eternal age, and it uses various language. It doesn't use the language of God dwelling in their midst, the Revelation 21 language. It uses the language of the world to come, the heavenly country. And there in chapter 4, of course, it uses strikingly the language of rest, doesn't it? Sabbath rest. There remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God, talking about that future age. And I want to say then that concept, that vision of the future age, that description of it as a Sabbath rest, that beautifully and perfectly complements the Revelation 21 vision of it as God dwelling amongst his people. That is to say, when God dwells amongst his people in the fullest sense, that will be consummate rest. That will be consummate, perfect rest. Now, why am I talking about that? Well, because I think that idea actually is here in Exodus. In my rather controversial opinion, the only part of a donut that's really worth eating is the fruity bit in the middle. And so on the rare occasions that I eat a donut, I get a knife and I kind of start at the sides and cut into it and kind of cut smaller and smaller bits until I get to the jam bit from that side, and then do the same from the other side until I've just got the middle bit left. And sometimes we're supposed to read parts of the Bible in that way, that we're supposed to start at the outer edges and cut in and cut in and cut in and work inwards and inwards and inwards. And sometimes we're supposed to do that on a small scale with just a little bit of Bible, and sometimes we're supposed to do it on a bigger scale with a bigger bit of Bible. And I think we're supposed to do it here in Exodus, in quite a big section, from chapter 24, verse 12, so the start of our passage this morning, through to chapter 31, verse 18. Now, I don't want to lose you in the details of all this, so just very quickly, I'll go through this. So the outer sections then are the actual beginning and end verses. So chapter 24, verse 12 on the one hand, and chapter 31, verse 18. You notice they both speak about the tablets of stone. So Moses is to go up and get the tablets of stone at the beginning, and then at the end in chapter 31, verse 18, he actually does receive from God the tablets of stone. You move into the donut a little bit more, and in chapter 24, verses 13 to 18, and chapter 31, verses 12 to 17, we have the idea of 6 days followed by a seventh. So you notice that here in chapter 24, there are 6 days followed by a seventh when Moses is called into the cloud. And then you have it in that, toward the end there, you have some more instructions about the Sabbath. And then going into the donut a little bit further still, in chapter 25, verses 1 to 9, and chapter 31, verses 1 to 11, you have the roles involved in the tabernacle construction. So kind of how the people are to contribute, we talked about that in our passage, and then at the end in chapter 31, how there are going to be these men who are going to build it and actually put it all together. So the roles involved, the Israelite roles involved in the tabernacle construction. And that then leaves a large jammy bit, the middle part of the donuts, chapter 25, verse 10, to chapter 30, verse 38, and that is the tabernacle design itself. That's all about the tabernacle itself. Now, what's the point of this? Well, as then you work in from the outside into the middle, from both ends, I think there's a logical sequence then that goes like this. First, law, tablets of stone. Then, Sabbath rest, 6 days followed by seven. Then, tabernacle. And I think the point of that sequence is something like this. It's saying to us, and this might seem strange to us because we're not used to reading literature like this, but the ancient Israelites were. It's saying something like this. At the heart of the law is the Sabbath. And at the heart of the Sabbath is God dwelling with his people. At the heart of the Sabbath rest is God dwelling closely with us. And so that leads me to say this then, as I really do close. I think we have something of a spectrum. And at one end of that spectrum is being utterly without God. Remember how Paul uses that language, Ephesians 2:12, without hope and without God. At one end of the spectrum is being utterly without God. And that is the state of supreme restlessness. And it exists fully in hell. That's where it exists fully. But to a significant extent, it's experienced by those who reject the gospel in this life. There's a restlessness in their hearts. At the other end of the spectrum is having God dwelling in close proximity to us. And that is the supreme state of rest. Perfect, complete rest. And that exists fully then in the world to come, when God will dwell completely amongst his people. But that too is experienced to some extent now by those who embrace the gospel and who know God and trust in Jesus Christ, so that Jesus can say, can't he, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest for your souls. And so I just throw out this to you as a challenge to you then this morning. Our souls as human beings are wired up for intimacy with God. They are designed to be in close relationship with God. And to lack that close relationship with God is to experience a deep unsettledness, a deep inner restlessness. It's mitigated to some extent now, but if you don't have God and you carry on without God and you die without God, then you will enter an eternal state where God is nowhere near you, and that restlessness will just consume you and devour you in the most horrible way. And so I say to you, as someone wired up to be in close proximity to God, come to God through Jesus Christ, the one who said, come to me. And you will know straight away throughout the rest of your life on earth, you will know a peace, a settledness, a rest in the depths of your being. Because that void that is there is being filled by that with which it was designed to be filled. And then the day will come finally when rest will consume every aspect of your existence, as God says, now my dwelling is with you, and you will gaze upon the beauty and glory of God for all eternity. Come to Jesus and know rest now to a significant degree, and then eternally in the most perfect sense. Come. Amen. Well, let's close singing 579. I heard